Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? Isn't that fair? Throw it away. All right? All right! They're coming! The rats are coming! Thousands of them!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord! It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family. From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 186, the remake of Wes Craven's classic, The Hills Have Eyes, from 2006.
Yeah, so we're back in remake territory, and this was something that was very endemic in, I mean, it's still happening, obviously, but in the early part of the new millennium, we just were given a spate of remakes from films from the 70s and 80s, go on and on, but I mean, they remade Last House on the Left, they remade Friday the 13th, they remade Nightmare on Elm Street, Evil Dead, they remade Carrie, they remade
Prom Night. Oh my god.
And these are
overwhelmingly bad.
So many remakes and varying degrees of quality.
To be charitable, yeah.
Although I have yet to see a remake, and I'm talking about the modern day remakes, that have really blown me away and made me think, well, this has a real reason for existing and to supplant the original. We're not talking about David Cronenberg's The Fly here. We're not talking about John Carpenter's The Thing. You know, these were wholly original films that were wonderful in their own merits that just took inspiration from the original. These were remakes. And you gotta ask yourself, why were they making all of these remakes? Why are they still making these remakes?
Cha-ching. Well, you know, for no other reason than that. And how much territory can you possibly cover? Almost everything has been done. If it hasn't, then I don't know about it. I still think there's room in film for a proper horror movie about nuclear radiation. China Syndrome is awesome, not really a proper horror movie. The original Hills Have Eyes obviously has incredible nuclear apocalypse motif running through it, but I don't think there's been like a really kick-ass movie in this space. And why I'm mentioning that is because I kind of like hazmat suits and Geiger counters, and as a body horror fan, I like the idea of being subjected to something that cooks you from the inside when you don't know about it and gives you cancer. That gives me the creeps. And when I saw a movie like Chernobyl Diaries, it was like egg, you know, they had this incredible opportunity to make something cool, and then again it just sort of fell flat. So we'll see whether this one fell flat.
Well, we get some hazmat suits at the beginning of this movie, but not much of it. And the raison d'etre, I guess, for the mutants in this one is nuclear fallout. Now, as far as the original goes, I don't believe... Was there nuclear... Was that the reason? Or were they just feral?
I think so as well, because it would have... I think New Mexico Desert, it was the birthplace of the atomic bomb in the States, and that was where the first one was set. So I think there was something, but it's been, and we got to be honest, it's been a while since we've seen the original.
And I was hoping to revisit it before we recorded this, so I could make some comparisons. Unfortunately, I didn't have time to. But from my understanding, and obviously I could be dead wrong, the quote-unquote mutants or freaks, or whatever you want to call them, were just feral, backwards individuals, but I could be dead wrong, it could be. Mm. But with this one, the nuclear fallout motif is extremely heavy.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's only used as a excuse or as a reason as to why these antagonists are the way they are. And there's not really a message in terms of, you know, pro or con, in terms of nuclear testing or nuclear energy.
Yeah, after sort of a heavy-handed beginning where it shows a bunch of mutants, victims, used actual stock footage of victims of meltdowns. And then, but after that, it really didn't touch on that so much. It turned more into an in-group, out-group, almost Texas Chainsaw Massacre mm-hmm. dynamic of interlopers, not so much. So I guess, yeah,
well, it's interesting because, you know, when you mentioned doing this movie, The Hills Have Eyes remake in particular, not the original, but the remake for the podcast, I had some trepidation.
Hmm.
The reason being is because I recall watching this way back in 2006 and probably being like, okay, there's a lot of good gore, it's fairly brutal, but not really enjoying it. The director of this movie, and I'm going to ask you to pronounce it for me.
Alexandre Aja.
Yeah. Obviously, he's somebody that, you know, he's somebody you want to watch, right? Because he burst on the scene with his film
High Tension.
And this is one of other films coming out of France, you know, really extreme horror. Films like L'Interieur, i.e. Inside, Martyrs, Frontiers. And so he was sort of lumped to that French extreme movement. Also, Gaspar Noé's Irreversible, etc., etc. And then he was sort of picked up by Hollywood, and he went on to do this remake here. He also did a remake that I found very enjoyable,
which we are going to talk about soon.
Yeah, and that was the Piranha remake in 3D. But to me, that because the original Piranha was sort of like a lark, you know what I mean? It was a fun film.
Yeah,
it's a great film, Giordano's Piranha.
Yes,
but it's not a film that you take altogether too seriously. So a remake that sort of exemplifies the sort of fun, campy elements of the original and ratchets up the gore is wonderful. I had a great time, and the 3D just made it even more exciting. But with The Hills Have Eyes, you know, the original is considered to be a bona fide horror classic. And we've talked a lot about Wes Craven on this podcast before, and we haven't been kind to him. And I've called him a two-hit wonder. And those two hits really would be Nightmare on Elm Street and The Hills Have Eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And
a bunch of very flawed pieces of work.
Yeah.
Red Eye, which just went, it had an incredible premise and was two-thirds of which was pretty fantastic and then got so ridiculous that it was almost unwatchable. Mm-hmm. But he needs to be reined in somehow.
Yeah, I'm not the biggest fan of The Last House on the Left. We revisited Scream for our podcast.
Mm, it's a mixed bag.
So, I mean, I think Craven, as I said before, he's the least of the best. In terms of all of the horror icons,
the
ones that we consider mm-hmm. to be on the Mount Rushmore of horrors, and this, again, would be your Carpenters, your Cronenbergs, your Fulcis, your Argentos, and on and on.
Mm.
I consider Wes Craven to be on the lowest rung. He's made the least amount of bona fide classics. But The Hills Have Eyes, as far as I'm concerned, is one of them. And then here we are, all these years later, remaking this movie. And so you said, okay, let's podcast The Hills Have Eyes remake. And I thought, okay, sure, why not?
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm watching this, I was sort of struck with the fact that this almost reminded me of a weird combination of Texas Chainsaw Massacre,
as you
mentioned,
mm-hmm.
with a little bit of the original The Hills Have Eyes, with some Straw Dogs in there, and even just a tinge of Home Alone. it was an interesting combination. Taking those four movies, mashing it up in a blender, throwing in some extra brutality, and then we're left with Alexandre Aja's 2006 remake of The Hills Have Eyes.
Well, that really comes to the fore when you're... I was thinking about the wind chimes in the house, in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre house, and that sort of mise-en-scene was almost reproduced here, except with, instead of a house, you have a trailer and whatever else, but I mean, he almost took some shots directly from that, and also with a bunch of people who's, in the case of this movie, who just stumble into a situation that they didn't expect to be in and get feasted upon by some, like, cannibal mutants. So it really is, I mean, the parallels are
mm-hmm.
right there.
Yeah, even right down to sort of like the big, continually berated simple guy
who's
an antagonist. I guess he would be sort of inspired by Michael Berryman's Pluto in the original.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall him giving a name in the remake, so I'm just going to call him Bluto. And he reminded me, you know, he was like the Leatherface character. So there's that. It's a family. Maybe not a nuclear family, but it's a family. It's people banding together.
Is that a pun?
Nuclear family. Yeah, exactly. Not pun intended. Interesting. Family banded together against outsiders. If anything, what makes this film a little bit different, there's a co-conspirator who's sending people to them.
Mm-hmm.
For reasons sort of unexplained. We don't know why.
No, but I guess in just keeping with the fine horror tradition where someone tells people about something and
first
then
of all, having like
lead them astray.
A dilapidated gas station. That's one part of horror tradition.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess, well, as a counterweight to the nuclear family, because I just love that, is the, what is it? Is it the Spencers or the Carters, my bad. The Carter family is on vacation. And this is like, they're going out to California, and this is heard on the soundtrack where they have various references to California Dreamin', a very like steeped in irony song.
Steeped in ubiquity?
Well, that too, yeah. And they're quite well developed as in comparison to TCM. They have very ironic jobs. So the son-in-law is in telecommunications, which is funny in a way because there's a common trope in films where you need to get help and you can't get a cell signal, and then you're lost in the woods, you can't, and then the character here works in telecom and complains at one point, we have 98% coverage and not here. So again, like, they actually explain it away and go one further that this is actually his actual business, which is kind of fun. His father-in-law, the patriarch of the family, is some gun-toting tough guy who is a former
ex-cop
who wants to...
Card-carrying member of the NRA.
Yes, and then he's a Democrat, and there's tension between the two of them. Well, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican.
The son-in-law's a Democrat.
Son-in-law's a Democrat in new media, broadly speaking. The father is the NRA guy, and he is, again, this is... he's in that ironic profession because he's a security consultant. And so this is, I think, kind of great because you have a guy who at one point says, prayers are fine, but I got bullets. This guy loves his guns. He loves his security. He's an army cop guy, but he proves to be effectively useless in the fight. So for all his self-defense macho bravado, he's not the one who saves the day here, which I thought was kind of neat. And their kind of family internecine battle is struck me as kind of... I don't know, realistic, because road trips are a mixed bag. You drive and drive and drive. Sometimes you see beauty, and other times you're sick to death of it. And so there's a family of, what, six, I want to say here? We'll count them off.
Well, you got the husband, you got the wife, you've got the daughter, you've got the... I talked about the eldest daughter.
Mm-hmm.
You got her husband, the son-in-law. That would be Doug.
Doug, yeah.
Then you've got the younger brother, who I believe his name is Bobby.
Bobby, yeah.
And Bobby's sister, Brenda... And then there's also a baby, the child of Doug and his wife. So how many of that? How many?
I don't know.
Well, counting when I was.
I think we got the bases covered there. So.
No, but I want to, because you said it was ironic that the ex-cop was now a security consultant. How, I don't understand the irony there.
Well, just like of all the jobs you're meant to have. He's a security consultant, and security is all about safety. It's almost like the Volvo in A Nightmare on Elm Street. Like, he's supposed to be a guy who knows how to keep people safe. And not only does he not, his behavior is terribly reckless. So, like, it's fair to say that he shouldn't be in security. He takes a shortcut and a tip from this lunatic, toothless... Hick runs this gas station.
I'm going to have to take on birth with you. He did have a full set of teeth.
Okay.
He might as well have been toothless, but no. Otherwise,
you have to take extreme care when you're driving through parts of New Mexico and Arizona, because in the day it easily, and I know this because a friend of mine just got back from Phoenix, it easily reaches 46, 47 degrees Celsius. So if you're taking some shortcut at the behest of some guy, like, I would sooner stick to my maps, because that's a guarantee you're going to be able to make it through. He doesn't, and of course, to his peril.
Well, it's interesting, because you mentioned that the youth felt that the characters were developed, and in my opinion, they weren't, in the sense that they used sort of shortcuts, storytelling shortcuts, to develop the characters. When we first meet the family that are on route to California, heading through the desert for a more scenic route, and they stop for some gas at this station run by this sort of
cantankerous
eccentric derelict, who is basically working in cahoots with the mutants. Mm-hmm. And we should explain that these mutants are the result of years and years and years of nuclear testing, nuclear fallout. Some of them were miners that were working in the area. They were told to leave their homes. They didn't want to leave. They stayed, and now they're there, deep in the New Mexican desert, and they're hungry. They're up to no good. It was established that they're cannibals. It was established that they're... Like, why do they need these people?
The short answer would be to replenish themselves as a population, because they're isolated from anyone else. So they have to sort of take captives and... for lack of a better term, because one of them does make an attempt, rape them and create an extra family. They don't really suggest that they're, because cannibalism is not linked to radioactive poisoning.
Well, no, but, I mean, they stole a baby, so
to take wives, yeah.
But, you know, again, like, it's one thing in TCM, when you're left to your own devices and people intrude upon your property and you have to defend yourself. Yes, this was a cannibalistic clan in TCM. But I thought they were way more developed and way more sympathetic because of that, because they were the ones whose property was intruded upon. Mm-hmm. They were the ones who were going about their day as if
nothing happened.
Was happening. And then these teenagers intrude upon their property, they're discovered, they need to defend themselves. In this one, they have this sort of system worked out with the proprietor of the gas station, where he lures people or sends people to them. He's the one that whispers their ear, hey, by the way, there's a shortcut. You might go this way instead of that way. It's not on the map, but do it. At the beginning of the movie, they sort of talk about, oh, he's saying, I'm out, I don't want to do this anymore. He's expressing reservations. He's yelling for someone by the name of Ruby, who is a member of this clan of mutants, perhaps the most sympathetic one. Well, she is the most sympathetic one. But all the same, when the truck pulls up for gas and the trailer's hoisted behind, the first thing that we see is an American flag on the antenna. And the cop, Bobby Sr., gets out.
Big Bobby.
And right away, here you can tell that he is alpha male, NRA member, red state, 100%. And this was a film made in 2006. Mm-hmm. Now we're in 2017. And the divisions between the red state and the blue states and the values and the actions and the perceptions of those that live in the red state versus the blue states have been exemplified to the utmost degree, mostly by the media. And this has to do with the political climate in the states right now, but there's always that tension, right? And this film was exploring that back in 2006. I think if they did it now, if they would have remade this now, it would have been even more.
Oh yeah, possibly.
They would have exploited that real difference. But all the same, I did not like the fact that the way this film developed the characters was, you're Republican, you're patriotic, that's shorthand for macho, that's shorthand for I'm going to take care of my family at all costs, and if you're a Democrat, if you wear glasses, that's shorthand for wuss. And at the very beginning, when we first meet Doug, and he's trying to fix an air conditioner very ineffectually, we're meant to,
that's what I kind of liked about that, because it flips it on its head. You have a guy who's supposed to be this protector, who's a macho, who fancies himself someone useful in a dire situation, who completely fails to be. Mm-hmm. And the kid is modeled, Bobby Jr. is modeled after the father, who's a gun-toting kid who thinks he's the cat's meow as well, and who's actually kept in check by Doug to say, like, listen, we need a plan. So the two of them almost use their... I guess combined strengths to fend off the mutants toward the end. So it's interesting. They need one another. You can't just have unbridled macho. You need reflection and foresight and planning and who knows what. You need a doer and a thinker.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing about Doug, who is a pacifist, who is a Democrat, there's a joke made at his expense at one point by Big Bob. Oh, he's a Democrat, something about
that. Oh, yeah. Well, there's lots of talking in this movie, which is why I thought, like, I don't know if that's necessarily a substitute for character development, but it's pretty unique in horror to have this much banter, intra-banter, if that's even a word, within the family.
But the whole conceit of the pacifist being pushed to the limit
Oh, Straw Dogs.
Well, it's just Straw Dogs. Yeah. And the character of Doug was modeled directly. That was a direct homage.
Mm-hmm.
From appearances, obviously he's bespectacled. And, yeah, that was the whole thing. It was a modeled after Dustin Hoffman character, who is a pacifist who gets pushed and pushed and pushed and he can't take any more. And then he sort of flips side, turns heel, so to speak.
Yeah, excellent. Becomes always down for a wrestling reference.
You got it.
Yeah.
And, yeah, there, I even felt like, you know, there was a one shot where they showed his glasses when he was starting to become a bit more violent, and you see his glasses on the ground, and they're cracked, and that just was like a direct homage to, like, some of the iconic images from Straw Dogs. But what I'm saying is that other than the fact that, hey, you're a Democrat, you're a Republican, this is how we're going to develop who you are, that was a shorthand. That was what they used so that we know who these characters are. And frankly, the female characters in this movie are pure ciphers.
That's true. I mean, they really, with the exception, I think they needed, you know, we're not trying not to spoil it, obviously, but they kind of needed a final girl, because whoever wrote this, and I wanted, did Aja write this? It felt like they didn't have the kind of the same agency. Although the mother defends herself with incredible courage in the face of adversity, but the
like
fact that
she's a bullet to the stomach for
for the other mother, you know, they both didn't come fair too well. But they showed incredible courage, but they weren't as well developed as the others. So this seems driven by the three males in the family, which is interesting, despite one surviving.
Mm-hmm. Of the three, two of them get dispatched midway through the movie in pretty horrific fashion, and that could have been shocking.
Okay, well, to its credit, I would say, like, okay, spoiler, it's rare to see someone linger on in horror, because they generally just die on the spot. So it was interesting, and I thought, this sort of turned expectations a little bit, because I thought she was finished. We won't say who. This particular woman was finished and then lingered on later. And so, I thought it was sort of interesting.
Although, if you watch Funny Games, whether it be the American remake or the original, you'll see that in extremely excruciating detail. So, but for an American horror, I guess, I mean, you have here we have an American horror with French directors, so there is some European sensibility.
Oh, and it shined through so much, because a lot of this stuff, like, you could tell this was directed by a foreigner, I think, in a way. Like, there's lots of use of American flag that I don't think an American director would use, because they're a little bit more sensitive to these issues than maybe the Europeans would be. I thought it was neat to have a Gulfstream trailer going through the wilderness, because, and then with the American flag being so prominent, and it gets used later to great effect. Like, there's nothing more American to me than open space and freedom, because they always tout the freedoms they always have, right? Like, oh, we're free to free or die.
States,
you know, the
America.
License plate and all
that
stuff,
course,
right?
Because as we know, the United States of America is the only free country in the entire
world. Oh, yeah, of course. But, I mean, they're the ones, like, you know, we share those freedoms.
I apologize to our American listeners.
We share the freedoms, but don't tout them as aggressively as they do. Apologies. But, yeah.
Canada and the majority of Europe enjoy same freedoms as...
Maybe not with free speech, but, yeah, again, very similar, like, in the Western world. But they tout it. And they shouted from the rooftop. So I thought that was like a little dig at the States by a foreign director to say, you know, here's an American flag, like, here's your freedom, people. Mm-hmm. And they're driving through and they're
shoving up your neck.
Yeah, so yeah. Like, and getting back to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like, the other similarity is that technological change is the theme in both films. Like, on the first Hills Have Eyes, you have warning of the dangers of this new technology. Not new at the time, because it was used in the 50s and testing in those atolls in the South Pacific when they leveled islands with the nukes. But, yeah, like, warning of the dangers of nuclear fission, or is it fusion? Mm-hmm. I always forget the difference. And in TCM, mechanical change
automation affecting the slaughterhouse operations.
And people being... Well, in this case, it was underscored by the mutants, which is, I think, Latin for change. It's mutant, mutable. So you change genetically. But also, here, like, you have walkie-talkies. So these mutants live in another time where technology has passed them by. They're living like savages with barely any technology. The new people come in with their newfangled devices, and they're gleaming.
Oh, we got to remember, they didn't come in. They were lured in. A big, big distinction.
Oh, fair enough, yeah.
Yeah, TCM, in my opinion, I'm talking about the original, of course, had a lot of subtext. And we talked about that on our TCM podcast. It was a movie sort of made in the post-Vietnam era. And there was the subtext of the invader. There was a subtext of, you know, the economic change and, of course, of the automation. You have a family who relied on a slaughterhouse for their income, and then they're pushed out, and they have to fend for themselves and survive.
And small business. Ma and pa shop.
Yeah. And so despite its reputation as a gore fest, as a geek fest, TCM is not. TCM is an extremely harrowing, white-knuckled ride, but there's a lot to say. It has a lot to say. Like I said before, a lot of subtext, and it's not a geek show. And the reason I use that word geek show is because I'm thinking about our mutually favorite, dear departed favorite critic, Roger Ebert, who, although we both loved him as a critic, he had a lot of disdain for the horror genre. And I don't know how many times he'd be reviewing a horror film on his, whether it be in his print reviews or on the show, where he would call it a geek show. Mm-hmm. And that was his shorthand term for just puerile gore and maybe disgusting creatures. This is a geek show. This is a geek show.
Yeah, because as we were just stepping in from a cigarette break here, like I was unaware that, because we agreed to watch obviously the same version, the unrated version, which is uber violent and uber long in my opinion, but I was not aware that this added a bunch of extra footage, and it seemed like toward the end there was an excuse to show people in gruesome states. And
of mutation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, for example, let's just
take away from, I thought, like a thrilling narrative to have it sort of back-ended by just constant...
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, with the first movie, the original, again, I'm just going from memory, but there was a real verisimilitude to it, and I think that was because of low budget. And there wasn't a lot of room for prosthetics and makeup and, Greg Nicotero's, K&B company to come in and make up these characters. So you had, and I mean this in the most respectfully possible, the wonderful Michael Berryman, who pretty much is a human special effect, playing Pluto, and everybody else was just sort of feral. Whereas here, you got characters like the Lizard, and he looks somewhat lizard-like, and you got... The mutations are getting—they're just a little silly in this.
A little more overly expanded to maybe accommodate a different audience, a newer audience, maybe. I don't know. You had like a little kid who's almost like Cronenberg's Brood, like wearing like a robe and lurking about and being the effectively like TCM, the one with the heart, a little bit of heart.
That's
beneath the exterior of the
yeah. And I mean, I remember when I first saw this movie, and I remember very vividly because I had rented it as soon as it came out on DVD. And when we are introduced to one of the mutants, who is sort of an antagonist, but in a sort of passive way, and the only name I'm going to give him is Big Head Man, right? And when I first saw him, it was shocking.
It was like cerebrospinal fluid. I forget what that affliction is, where your like brain swells up, but it was pretty, and they're wheelchair bound, and it's that's an intense.
But yet he's also calling the shots on the walkie talkie. Yes. So he's antagonist in a passive way. He's wheelchair bound. He can't get off. That shocked me. But then seeing it again, revisiting, I'm just like, oh yeah, there's Big Head Man again. You know, it lost its capacity to shock upon second viewing. That's why the first time you see, you're like, oh wow, that's bizarre. But then seeing it again, It just didn't have any resonance for me.
Huh. See, I would say, like, the scenes that really resonated with me was with the menacing stuff. Because, again, I'm not a fan of the torture porn that was bandied about when this came out, and it's from the same era, too, as Saw, as it came out within a year of that film. So you have, like, inside the trailer, the woman being menaced and raped, that stuff really touched me. I found that very, very compelling, and I was quite moved by how the husband lost the mother of his child and went on a search for his young baby that was kidnapped. I found that very deftly handled in a way, but I guess, yeah, if there was a debit to this, I would say the length and the geekery, for lack of a better word. Getting back, you said turn heel. Wrestling, what always took me out of wrestling was a suspension of disbelief when someone got beaten down too badly. And in the case of this gentleman here, this Doug, he incurs such a beating at the hands of these mutants that I thought, like, come on. Like, he gets his digit lopped off by an axe. Mm-hmm. He's beaten, hit with a baseball bat, and he just continues to come forward like he's some indestructible, like Jason Voorhees and Hulk Hogan or something. And that always hits a sour note with me when that happens. And it took me out of it a little bit because It's not in his character. Sure, you can rise to the occasion. You're a geek. You're an IT guy. You're a tech guy. But within reason, like he was like Schwarzenegger battling back, and that didn't. Again, the last 15 minutes, it sort of withered away. And the capital it had built up before that, with some genuine scares, was a little bit lost toward the end.
I was going to say, I guess the film is saying, when you push a man too far, he's capable of anything, adrenaline, whatever. But this is me, sort of filling in the gaps.
But he's not even Charles Bronson in Death Wish. He's like an ex-military. Like, he's a tough man who you could expect to perform certain feats. No. And there's just something, it didn't...
There's this shot where he's got a hold of an axe and he's going to town on the mutants. And he takes the axe and he sort of does this cool little flip, so he's got the pointy end.
Yeah.
To do a little damage. The way that was shot, it was... almost straight out of, something with like a Bruce Willis or Schwarzenegger or
exactly.
And so, I too sort of didn't buy that near the end.
And also, another credit, but I'm going to give a debit as well, how I have said it a couple times on this podcast, when a pet meets with its demise, that you're in for something hard. I like animals, and I thought it takes a certain... set of balls to be able to play with audience expectations to kill pets. I thought that was pretty interesting.
I remember the first time I ever saw a dog killed in a horror movie. And it was when I was in a young, impressionable age. And it wasn't the original Halloween because I had seen... the first Halloween movie I had seen, and it was at a slumber party, was Halloween 4. And Michael Myers killed a dog. And I was taken aback. I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. This was taking me right out of my comfort zone. Like, you don't kill the family pet. You don't kill
the master. Which is so arbitrary. Because you kill everybody else.
I know. It's so funny how, we have no sympathy for the human beings. And it's slasher. Kill them all. Kill all the cats. Well, as soon as you kill Fido, oh no. Mm. But it's been done. And the killing of the family pet doesn't bother me anymore. Getting back to Doug, I'm sure that they wanted to throw in the subtext that deep down we're all savages at heart. We're no different than the mutants. Lord of the Flies, right? Mm-hmm. When push comes to shove, we're all savages at heart.
Because young Bobby is armed and Second Amendment gun toting kid. Even he's a great shot, and when he's under attack, he can fend for himself even though he's 16. But he's like, he wants to go in guns a blazing, and his brother-in-law there, Doug, just sort of holds him back and keeps him in check. So he still has his wits about him. He's still trying to think strategically, try and think of a way he can get his family out of the situation. So, again, do you charge in like the charge of the Light Brigade, or do you hold back and try and, try and strategize? And ultimately, this family does both, because young Bobby does run off to try and, save the day, as it were, with full of teen braggadocio. But this family, they set up a tripwire, they light a tire on fire with some accelerant to try and generate a big fire so that they can be seen, which is, again, ludicrous because they're out in the middle of nowhere. They jerry-rig a propane tank to kill one of the mutants. So they do show their ingenuity. Again, if it depends on whether that affects you or not, very straw dogs.
And a little Home Alone-y.
Home Alone, yeah. And ingenuity in the face of adversity is not new to the horror genre. Right. So this, again, plays on it, and we get to see... And really, as you said before, we get to see it only from the Y chromosome, speaking of genetics and mutation. Y chromosome, half of it, because the women are fairly ineffectual. They resort to complaining, being like the voice of reason to just calm people down, and that's about it, essentially. And then one little bit of heroism, but mostly this is a very male-driven film. So I guess have we reached the point in our discussion where we turn to what we've learned?
Yeah, I'll start.
Okay.
What I've learned is that when you have a mediocre film and you start throwing in more and more tropes, it makes the film even more mediocre. And there was some tropes in this movie that just made me shake my head and go, oh, for God's sakes.
Well, are you going to say Doug speaking into the walkie-talkie saying, why are you doing this to us?
No.
No, okay, because that really took me out of it, because And not because he said, why are you doing this to us, which annoys us, it's a bugbear for both of us, it annoys us to no fucking end. Mm-hmm. Why are you doing this to us? Because you're a psycho. It's obvious why you're doing this to us, but why would you divulge your position, and why would you, like, you shouldn't communicate with people who are going to attack you. It's ludicrous. It does you no good. And then at one point he says, give me back my baby. It's like, just shut up, maintain radio silence. It's not like you're John McClane from Die Hard goading the terrorists.
It's so funny
like,
to say that because...
stay fucking quiet.
In the last...
don't talk.
In the last few days, for some reason, I just got to this Die Hard kick, and I've been having a Die Hard marathon watching film in succession.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
I'm watching John McClane goading the terrorists with his Walkman. So when he said that, I'm like, hey, man, John McClane. Yeah. But these are two different spheres. We got the action sphere versus the horror sphere.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
The tropes I'm referring to, first of all, Big Head Man... I might as well also call him Exposition Man, because...
Oh, toward the end, he's explaining everything.
As soon as Doug comes upon him, and he's, you made us what we've become, you and your testing, and he's just going on and talking about, you know, it's straight out of a comic book when the villain
explains... Oh, of course,
explains,
and as he says, this is the last 15 minutes where things just fall mm-hmm. flat.
And then the other one, the other trope, and this always happens in slasher films, is the whoops... He's dead. No, he's not dead. He always comes up for one last
go
kick
around
of the can. I'm fed up with that. I don't know why the last, the big boss, so to speak, wasn't mutated at all. Maybe he was someone that was kidnapped back then.
Oh, well, I guess mutations came in varying degrees, mm-hmm. Depending on levels of radiation. You know?
Yeah,
This stuff has not been known for very long, so then, it's an interesting...
And just a little bump at the end where it's like, okay, it's over, we're safe, and there's that little bump. Oh, no, you're not safe. There's an indication that there's somebody left and something's going
to
happen.
Well, the somebody left, as I said, like, and with my wrestling analogy, like, it was too much toward the end. There was just the last guy remaining. It's like, okay, enough. You survived. You used the flag with incredible guile and ingenuity. No more fighting. No more killing is required after the flag. The flag was the film's centerpiece of a cool kill, and then afterward, you're just beating it to death. And again, I think that comes from the overlength. It would be interesting to see the non-unrated version because there's 15 minutes that I would have cut out from this toward the end because, again, when I wrote my review on the site, I thought it built up a lot of capital that was somewhat ruined toward the end that I didn't really appreciate. But in that, it has that in common with a lot of films that tend to dissipate in terms of terror.
I guess some of these tropes, like the killer... dead, coming back again for that one last attempt. Sure, that's straight out of your Friday 13s. I mean, Jason always had that, oh, he's dead, he's not quite dead. But that was different. In the 70s and 80s, that was part of the... By 2006, it's like, we'd like something different, something new. And unfortunately, we're now in 2017. It's 11 years hence.
Yeah.
And they're still using these tropes again and again and again. So, and the remakes are still coming fast and furious. So, that's what I learned. What did you learn?
Oh, well, again, it seems like they launched the film with nuclear motifs and warning about the dangers of...
Nuclear, Chris.
Nuclear. gotta love Springfield Nuclear Plant. So they introduce it. The mutants was very, very savage and insane when you see this. They really... I'm reading a book about genetics called The Gene by, the author is Siddhartha Mukherjee. Look it up, it's terrific. They only really knew that radiation caused genetic mutation by working on fruit flies in the 1920s in a lab in Columbia University. So they accidentally were doing some x-rays, they hit a bunch of fruit flies, and then the next generation of them came out with like weird little shapes and that. So I like it, as I said before, of... people being changed, mutated, mutable, like mutant from Latin, changing, and it freaks me out. But they set up this motif of nuclear something, and then they abandoned it. And then at the end, they brought in some guy for some exposition to talk about how it was you outsiders, and that's fine if you're going to run the motif throughout the film. You can't have an hour of non-nukes. Talk and no reference, and then all of a sudden, boom, you have the guy saying, oh, you and you moderns, for lack of a better word, coming in here and fucking us up. That's rang a little hollow to me. So that's one thing Yeah, one thing I definitely learned. Star rating.
I'm going to give this 2 stars.
Oh, okay.
2 stars flat.
All right, I'm going to give this 3 because of Alexandre Aja's kind of neat visual style at times, marred by over-length, various things I cited earlier. So I'm going to give it a 3. It's hard to separate remakes and try and treat them as normal films, for lack of a better word. I don't know, normal, abnormal, because the shadow, the long shadow of the Wes Craven original
looms
large, so it's really tough. If the other one didn't exist, I'd be more inclined to give this a more favorable review. You can't help but be influenced by that. And it, the sequel is just beyond god-awful, and none of the principles were involved from here. And that has no visual style. It's a bunch of military men lost in the desert in New Mexico. And that's okay. If you want to talk tropes,
yeah.
the military cliche of like, oh, you wop, oh, you spick, like where the guys bust each other's ethnic balls, that is so done to death. And you can do that because ball busting is fun, but not in the same way. It's like, oh, like the same fucking cliches for ethnic groups, like over and over. Oh, you greaser, oh, you like, you know, slant eyes. It's like, come on, man. You know, you do a little bit more with that. That was a terrible, terrible movie.
But that's okay, because Wes Craven's The Hills Have Eyes 2 was pretty god-awful as well. So that, I guess I'm keeping it in the spirit of the original. But
what's not awful, though, is our website, www.reallyawfulmovies.com, with a bunch of fun genre film reviews, predominantly horror. And check us out for new episodes of the podcast every Friday for your listening enjoyment. And we will talk to you soon.
Take care.